This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 1 month ago today, the largest earthquake in 40 years shook the earth near the coast of the island of Sumatra. Tsunamis generated by the quake tore across the Indian Ocean, rising into seaside towns and villages in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, Thailand, as far away as East Africa. A month ago, the estimate of those killed stood near 20,000. Today, nearly 300,000 are listed as missing or dead. And while worries of clean water, shelter, and disease still exist in many areas, relief organizations now turn their attention to longer-term challenges. Amidst the rubble and ruin, there are signs of hope and glimpses of generosity. School doors reopened for the first time today in the hard-hit Indonesian province of Banda Aceh. The Red Cross reported a record amount of donations, and Indonesian officials plan to resume peace talks with separatist rebels in Aceh for the first time in nearly 2 years. Later in the program, why the death toll in the 1906 San Francisco earthquake may soon rise sixfold, an update on today's rail crash in Glendale, California, and questions about what all those budget deficit numbers really mean. But first, an update on the tsunami a month later. If you have questions about how relief efforts are going, how victims are coping, about how much money's been spent and how it's being raised, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Ellen Nakashima, foreign reporter for The Washington Post. She joins us at this very late hour where she is from her home in Jakarta, Indonesia. And it's nice of you to stay up to speak with us.
Oh, it's good to be with you now.
You recently visited a village in Sumatra, not far away from the provincial capital, Banda Aceh. How were members of the community coping nearly a month after the tsunami hit?
Well, what struck me in this community is how many women and children were killed, leaving their husbands and fathers and brothers. And in this one village I visited, about 3 out of 4 survivors were men or boys. And they were caught by great sorrow and grief, but there was also a strong sense of resilience, pragmatic sort of determination to get through this. I found them in a relief camp in an elementary school on the outskirts of the capital, and every morning the men of this village would go back to the site of their old village on the sea, just flattened now, it's rubble and debris, and they would collect bodies of their fellow villagers and bury them. It was both a very sort of grim and sad gesture, but also one of caring and loving, because they were burying their fellow villagers. No one else was. Mm-hmm. And it was, in a way of getting through this grief for them.
How did it happen that there are 105 widowers and only 19 widows in this town?
What was very interesting, amazing to me, is in village after village along the coast, you found mostly men and boys surviving. Of course, these were fishing villages that were hardest hit, and the tsunami came on a Sunday morning when many of the men and boys were at sea. And this being a Sunday morning, there was no school, so the women and young children were at home. But when the water rose, it claimed some lives, but a fair number of men survived by clinging to capsized boats until they were rescued by larger boats, while those at home on the shore had virtually no chance once the waves slammed into their homes.
Hmm. What effect is this having on the structure of the village, the structure of these families that have been so dramatically changed?
Yes, in many cases you've got men now being the primary caregivers. These men said to me that, in a sense, their main purpose for in life was gone. There's no family, no wife, no children to care for. So even if they do have a job and earn some money, who do they bring it home to? Who do they share this with? And now the men who are left are in the position of having to care for the orphaned children and also care for each other, giving each other emotional support, which is something that they acknowledge was something they weren't quite used to doing.
As you look at this, a month after the tsunami, a month later, do they know if they're going to rebuild their village where it used to be? Are they going to relocate to higher ground? Do they know what's going to happen to them?
Their lives are sort of permeated by a sense of uncertainty. They're sitting in a school classroom, which in fact they're told they have to help to move out of because school is starting, as you noted, Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not sure where they're going to go. Will they be moving to another school or to tents somewhere? They're not sure if the government's going to help them rebuild their homes, and if so, where. These villagers would like to go back to their old village or somewhere nearby, if not right near the sea, then maybe a little inland, but they'd like to go back. They're just not sure they'll be able to do so. Everything is still a little unclear.
As you visit this village, obviously one of the things that has certainly happened after the tsunami was this amazing outpouring of generosity, people around the world, governments around the world, all kinds of organizations making donations. Can you see that in that village?
Well, these villagers were sitting in classrooms in a school, and there were piles of donated clothes on the floors in the classrooms, and they did have donated rice and some vegetables. But it wasn't clear in this village that any of the international relief was getting to them. The villagers said that they really couldn't know because relief was not distributed directly to them. They expressed gratitude for the generous outpouring they know was coming in from people around the world and across Indonesia, but they also expressed concern that the aid was not getting to survivors directly or that it would continue. They kept asking me whether the Americans would continue to stay and what kind of aid were the Americans giving. Would the international relief organizations stay in Indonesia? How long would they stay? This is all part of their uncertainty. Lives.
Do they want the government to help them, or do they want to rebuild on their own, or at this point do they just want some certainty?
Well, these are men who are used to being independent, been fishermen for 10, 20, 30 years, owning their own boats and homes, but now they are completely without no boats, no homes, no jobs. They realize they're dependent on outside aid, and they're looking to the government to help. They're hoping the government will help, but they're not sure it will, because at this point you really haven't seen evidence of much aid coming directly to them.
And as you say, this village that you wrote about, it seems this is not an anomaly. This same thing happened in many other places.
Yes, it happened in many other places along the north coast of Sumatra near Banda Aceh, the capital, and on the west coast. And anecdotally, I've heard some villages where the ratio of men to women is 4-1.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your staying up to speak with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Ellen Nakashima is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, and she joined us by phone from her home in Jakarta, Indonesia. If you have questions, if you have questions about what happened in the tsunami, what has happened since, about relief efforts, about how money is being raised or how it's being spent, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Back with us now to talk about relief efforts is Alfred Ironside, a spokesman for UNICEF. He's with us by phone from New York City. Good to speak with you again.
Hi, how are you?
You may not have been able to hear us, but we were talking about one village and how they're dealing with the loss of so many of the women in the village. Here's a question that is impossible to quantify. How are the children doing?
Yeah, it's very tough, Neil. And the thing we've been hearing from our people on the ground is just how very difficult it is for the families who've lost children. And I think we're beginning to come to terms with the scope of that problem as a starting point. And that was a story in one of the newspapers this morning about a small child in a hospital in Sri Lanka with nine different couples claiming him as theirs. And so it's a tragedy. It's a real tragedy for families who've lost children. And we're seeing now that more people have lost, more parents have lost children than children have lost parents. So it's very, very tough. And one of the things that we're trying to do to help children who survived cope is to get them back into some sort of learning environment, open up classrooms again.
Yet, as we also heard in that previous conversation, and again, I don't think you had a chance to hear it, schoolrooms were being used as shelters for some people. And, of course, you want school to reopen. What do you do with the people who are living there?
Yeah, that's a big challenge. In fact, both the governments of Sri Lanka and Indonesia have decreed, essentially, that they'd like to get schools open in all the affected areas. So it is a challenge to find new living space for those who are using the schools as temporary shelters. We're looking at a number of different options. Certainly using religious institutions is a good option. Many of those in Sri Lanka are already in use, the same in Indonesia, but that's an option that we're looking at. And then, of course, is the construction of temporary communities, tent communities or other kinds of temporary construction. That is happening so that we can begin to reuse the schools for children. And I think the governments recognize that this is truly a priority because to put the kids into a learning environment really restores some normalcy for them, and that will really help their families in the long run. Once children are taken care of and have a place to play and learn during the day where they can feel safe and they'll occupy themselves with positive activities, it really helps the adults in the community to focus on what they have to do and also to feel that sense of hope that things are returning to normal.
Alfred Ironside, stay with us, if you will. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation about last month's tsunami and the current efforts to help its many, many victims. Did you donate to the cause? If so, do you feel your money has been used well? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about recovery after the tsunami. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN@NPR.org. Speaking with us now is Alfred Ironside, a spokesman for UNICEF. And I did want to ask you, as we go from the period of emergency relief towards recovery, we were very concerned, and a lot of organizations were, right after the tsunami about cholera, malaria, gastrointestinal disorders. We're reading now, though, of a couple of diseases that are surprising people, one of them being tetanus.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, this is one of the immunizations that most kids here in our country get very routinely when they're born, and then they get booster shots. In fact, even as adults, we tend to get tetanus booster shots from time to time. If you don't have that, you can easily be infected. And you know, people know that any kind of open wound can easily be infected with tetanus. So yes, that is a serious problem, and it's truly one that we hadn't anticipated. I think the issue is, especially in Indonesia, in the province of Aceh, immunization rates were rather low, not quite 50% for the routine childhood diseases, of which tetanus is one. So those children are vulnerable, and that's something we have to begin now as a tetanus immunization campaign, in addition to measles, which is already underway.
Mm-hmm. Malaria, regrettably, no vaccine for that, but a lot of concern that malaria will be rampant because of all the new breeding grounds, breeding waters, rather, for mosquitoes.
Yeah, it's a chronic disease in those areas. It's a fact of life for most people, unfortunately. There are things you can do to prevent malaria, if not treat it, and certainly bed nets are a big part of that. Insecticide-treated bed nets really protect children and women during the nighttime when, of course, mosquitoes are most active. So that's something that we're also distributing in those endemic areas for malaria. But it is a part of life, unfortunately, and a little bit more of a problem now than in normal times.
Let's get some listeners on the line. Again, 800-989-8255. We'll start with Kel, who's with us from Miami Beach in Florida.
Hi, gentlemen. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello, Alfred. Yes, this is Mr. Rasmussen, and I just wanted to interject with this. I was reading the newspaper about Architecture for Humanity, and there was an organization something called Global Village Shelters that has prefab housing for $370. And I thought, you know, here as a young man, I had done AmeriCorps in the past. I'm 33 years old, and I really want to do something for these people overseas. I'm a Danish American. I'm very, very intercultural. I want the Miami area and the U.S. as a whole to really do something. And I know with the housing boom here in Miami, there's a wonderful opportunity for the architects down to the construction folk to do something about this. And I was wondering Alfred's thoughts on prefab and existing housing and how could that be sent over.
Right. Well, thanks for the question. That's not an easy one to answer. I know that in Indonesia especially, they're beginning to look at those kind of options because so many people have been displaced, and the whole town of Banda Aceh, or at least with two-thirds of it, is completely destroyed. So they are beginning to look at those kinds of alternatives. I think that that's a little bit further down the line, quite frankly.
Okay, I understand.
Okay.
So I appreciate that, gentlemen.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Anna. Anna's calling from Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
Hello there. My call was just regarding having donated to UNICEF myself. We were very quick to receive a receipt from UNICEF saying we'd given the money and thank you. If they have the back office to be able to email back out, I wonder if that can be taken on to the next step and sending weekly updates of just a top line what they're doing with the money. It is very hard to get feedback on exactly what they're doing, and that would be very helpful.
Well, thanks, Anna. I appreciate the feedback, and we certainly appreciate your contribution. I will pass that along. I know that they are looking at how we can provide an update to all the people who contributed to the UNICEF relief effort, and we'll be looking at that. You might check our website, www.unicef.org, which does have lots of feature stories, videos, audio clips, constantly updated virtually every day with stories from the field on what we're doing and how we're helping, how that money is being used. So if you have a chance to look on the web, that's one good place to start. But thanks for the feedback. We'll certainly look at how we can provide folks with regular updates.
Thank you.
Anna, thanks for the call. A lot of questions on the line are about the issue of money in some form or another. So let's bring Stacey Palmer, the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, into the conversation. She's with us by phone from her office here in Washington, D.C., and it's nice to have you back on the program.
Good to join you.
I wonder, the question you just heard that was put to Alfred Ironside of UNICEF, there are a lot of issues like that happening now, aren't there?
Yeah, and one of the things that it's very confusing as this whole situation goes on, and so I think, you know, donors need to get as much information as possible about what's going on.
And are they getting information back from organizations like UNICEF?
I think organizations have been working so hard, actually, to do the work, to actually do the relief work, that they haven't necessarily been able to quickly get as much information to people as possible. But many of them are using their websites to post information so donors can go there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are working on email newsletters and things like that to be able to inform donors about what's happening.
A month after the disaster, are donations still pouring in?
They are. They're coming in very, very fast. More than $500 million has already been raised, and the American Red Cross announced today that it has raised so much money it doesn't need to raise any more.
$500 million in private donations. You're not talking about government donations.
Yes, indeed. So the amount raised by private individuals surpasses how much the American government contributed.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Tony, who's with us from San Diego. Tony, I'm afraid your cell phone is betraying you. We can't understand a word you're saying.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this better?
Try it one more time.
Okay, I'll try once more. My concern is whether the charities are regulated and whether there is any sort of federal or government support.
I think we got you, Tony, but I'm going to have to hang up on you. I apologize. I think he was asking whether these charities are regulated. Is anybody providing oversight to on the amount of money given and how it's being used?
Nobody regulates that kind of thing specifically, and that's one of the things that's always very difficult in this kind of situation, is the fact that there's no overarching body that really is in charge, although the United Nations is clearly trying to coordinate the use of things. But we've got lots of different organizations in different countries working on things, and it's up to the state and federal government to monitor that charities in the United States are doing the right things with the donations.
Let's get another caller in. Carol's with us from San Diego.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
I have just gotten back from Aceh. My husband's from there. We were working with children before the tsunami. We haven't found any of our kids. And there are several things that I am upset about. It's hard for me to hear that they have so much money they're not even needing money anymore, when I've returned and the Achenese government that we have worked with, some wonderful people, are working out of a collapsed building that is not safe. They've not even been given an engineer. There are dead bodies throughout the building. We've been working day and night cleaning out those bodies. Not one Red Cross, anyone, anywhere, once getting those bodies. The bodies around the building stink. The Achenese government has lost themselves many people, and yet they're having to work out of that building. There are groups like myself that are small, that have, you know, been working there previously, and we're getting no help. And there are volunteers, young children from, 14 to 18, cleaning up bodies coming from Jakarta. A lot of them don't last many days because they don't get fed a lot of food. They don't have proper boots. And then you see all these wonderful cars and people going by with their flags and their banners, and it doesn't feel good.
Alfred Einstein, let's get a response from you.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. And I'm sorry, I didn't hear which town you said you were working in.
She was in Banda Aceh, yeah.
Was it in Banda Aceh? Yeah, I mean, it is. I completely appreciate that kind of frustration. I think the first thing we need to keep in mind is that no single organization is capable of doing all that's necessary. And I think all the big ones have tried to be responsible about saying our absorptive capacity has been reached. I mean, we have as many people as we can possibly deploy, and we're doing as much as possible with the money we've received. But if we get more, we're not going to be able to responsibly spend it ourselves. And so we have to turn the faucet off for us.
Don't you think the American people, when they're donating, are assuming that at least the Achenese government is getting a building so that they can go into it, at least some, and the buildings that are there are being rented at enormous rates by these charities so that they can't even afford, all that money is going to the Jakartans, so they can't even afford. So what the locals are seeing is that the buildings are being, the fancy buildings owned by the Jakartans are being rented by the charities, so their own government doesn't have a decent building to try to rebuild themselves in, that they are using their people to clean up the dead bodies, not the charities. They go to where the charities are, and you've got the food displays out there in the media, and then they hear the children have been, you know, taken from them when there are so many parents. There's no need for orphanages. I mean, our little place, which we have got no funds. I mean, I have cashed out my retirement fund doing this, and so have many others. Our little home, which has the Achenese government and everyone else involved, has parents who have lost, who are at that outer bazaar market, which is huge, mm-hmm. who have lost all their children and their husbands, and then all the children who have lost their parents that were at the inner market. And yet we've taken children from there, and they're showing constantly on the TV that guy saying that it's no different than what Mother Teresa did. So what's happening is the Achenese, which is very different, it's a unique culture, the Achenese are feeling a sense of fear. They're grateful, but they're also feeling a sense of fear. When you see...
Carol, I think we get your point that there's a great disparity between apparently the amount of money donated and the amount of help reaching people, at least the people you were talking about there in Banda Aceh. And again, let's give Alfred Einstein a chance to respond. Obviously, UNICEF can't speak for every organization.
Well, a couple of things. The first thing I'd like to do is offer this for you to contact my office sometime tomorrow, and I'd like to try and put you in touch with some folks on the ground who might be able to help you with your specific situation. I do feel like there's more we can do with what the information you're giving us is. So, Neil, if there's somewhere or other that my phone number can be transmitted here, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, Carol, if you could just stay on hold when we're done with you, and we'll get your phone number and we'll facilitate this.
That's wonderful. I appreciate
that. And to know that General Secretary Hanef, the head of all that, is given an office, it would just delight me.
No, I think we can be helpful, and I'd like to get the information, and we can pass it along and make some things happen for you.
Okay, Carol, I'm going to put you on hold.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the phone call.
I think just the other thing I'd want to add, Neil, is that it points out just how overwhelmed the government systems are. UNICEF and the other major players have to work with the Indonesian government in the lead. They are a sovereign government, and we are doing everything we can to facilitate them ensuring that local authorities are put back up and running as quickly as possible. But surely it's going to take some time, and I appreciate the frustration that she is expressing about what some of the local authorities at the very most sort of local district level are confronting at this point, when the relief from central government just isn't fanning out quickly enough.
We're talking about this tsunami 1 month later. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Stacey, I wanted to bring you into this conversation. There is this apparent discrepancy between the amounts of money raised and the amount of help reaching people today.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, some of the charities themselves are concerned about this. Oxfam put out a report today saying that they were concerned that there were a number of groups that were providing tsunami aid that got a lot of donations but didn't necessarily have all the skills to provide disaster relief in the best way possible. So that's one of the challenges that always happens is that, it's hard for us in the United States to figure out which groups are necessarily the best at providing aid. And so people just give money, and some of it reaches the beneficiaries very fast, and some of the groups are working very efficiently, and in other cases it doesn't necessarily work so well.
What happens to donations when, it was early days when Doctors Without Borders said, we don't need any more money for the very special thing we do. Now an organization as big as the Red Cross says that.
Yes, I think that they said that they'll keep receiving money till the end of the month, and so all the donations that people have made thus far will be put towards tsunami relief. But what they were trying to say is, starting next month, there's no reason to keep giving to this. Now, there'll be a lot of long-term efforts that will probably need support, and so I think donors can expect to see a lot more pitches. But for this specific relief, the emergency kinds of assistance, what the Red Cross is saying is we don't need any more help with that. And I think many charities are feeling that there's just nothing they can do with more money. They would need more people on the ground, and they don't have that.
Let's talk now with Avi. Avi's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi.
What the last caller said really resonates with me, and I have my friend's mother's been working in India for over 30 years, and she's in the tsunami areas right now.
Mm-hmm.
And what my main concern is that from what I hear from her that the women and children aren't getting the aid as much as the men are. And so she said that she realizes that all this money's coming in, but she's not seeing it used on the ground at all. And in India, the untouchables are expected to be the ones to clean up the bodies, but they were also the fishermen in the villages.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are they the ones the most affected, but they also have to clean up all the bodies, and they're the last ones to get the aid.
Alfred Ironside, can you help us out here?
Yeah, no, I mean, this points out two important issues. I mean, one is I think there's a lot of information and knowledge that's we're learning about what goes on in some of these societies that we wouldn't ordinarily be hearing about. I think the fact that the money that may be making its way down to community level is going into the male head of household is a traditional problem, and we know from experience in a lot of different countries that when the cash actually goes into the hands of the women, it's used more for the things that the family might actually need, especially care for the children. So these are long-term problems that we're confronting in our ongoing development work, that these are just spiking now that we have this kind of crisis that people are really noticing for the first time. But yes, I mean, this is a significant issue when we're doing not only emergency relief, but regular development work, how to make sure that, especially with cash grant type of programs, how does it get into the hands of the family member who will make the best use of it? So that's a classic conundrum that we work with.
Avi, thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
Alfred Ironside, thank you for your time today.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Neil.
Alfred Ironside is a UNICEF spokesperson, and he joined us by phone from New York City. Stacey Palmer, as always, we thank you for your time as well.
Thank you very much.
Stacey Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. She joined us by phone from her office here in Washington, D.C. When we come back from a short break, an update on a fatal train crash in California, an explanation of some confusing numbers in the federal budget, and in San Francisco, officials reevaluate the death toll from the 1906 quake. We'll find out why. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.